It is Sunday, March 20th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. In the next half hour, our correspondent in Havana tells us what it was like to spend the night with members of a prominent Cuban rights group on the eve of President Obama's landmark visit to Cuba. What do U.S. lawmakers think of the visit? We'll hear from our Senate correspondent. And
you like drugs. You like drugs to me. I'm so in. Do you totally? You like drugs. You like drugs to me.
Gwen Stefani has a new album out, and VOA Music's Nikki Strong tells us how it was influenced by the American pop star's relationships, past and present. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, President Obama has begun a three-day visit to Cuba, opening a new era of engagement with the island's communist rulers, who once were bitter foes of the United States. Obama flew to Havana on Sunday, making him the first U.S. leader to set foot in Cuba in 88 years. He was greeted by the country's foreign minister at the airport. For more on the visit, I spoke a short time ago to VOA correspondent Victoria Maki in Havana, and I asked her what the mood was like.
So I would say the mood is generally pretty excited. I mean, when there's a big event like this, and people keep referring to when the Pope came a few months ago, street repairs are made, buildings are painted, those kind of superficial things to make the city, spruce the city up a bit more, are really kind of what people notice most. Once you start getting into, asking people what they think about Obama's visit, then you start getting into politics, and it gets pretty tricky pretty quickly. You have a lot of folks who immediately associate the U.S. government, and especially Obama, with the embargo that's been on Cuba. Lots of people saying that that's the key to Cuban prosperity, to kind of getting out of this poverty level that's pretty crippling, is the U.S. lifting the embargo. On the other hand, we've talked with quite a few dissidents in the last few days, and, they see Obama's visit as, maybe a step back is something that maybe shouldn't be happening at this point, because it's really just, it's negotiating with the Castro government. And for people who really just want an end to the Castro government, this is validating, Raul Castro's current leadership, and they want nothing to do with that.
Well, I understand you have been meeting with some of those dissidents, members of the Ladies in White group, and some of them were actually arrested for protesting today in Havana. So what have you heard from them?
So it was very, very kind of them. I was the first foreign journalist who has ever stayed with them at their headquarters. They all camped out there overnight. There was about, I'd say, 55 to 60 of us, mostly women, a few men, partners of some of the women, in basically, two rooms, sleeping on mattresses on the floor. I stayed with them all night and then, went to the protest site with them this morning. They do this every week, and so, they hope for the best but really expect the worst. They generally find a lot of confrontation from the police. Sometimes all of them are detained. Sometimes some of them are detained. This is a political opposition group, and they really do suffer the brunt of, police activity when they go out and do these demonstrations. This morning started pretty well. We wound our way from their headquarters to the plaza and the church where they go every Sunday to go to Mass and then to have their demonstration. On the way there, there were no problems. We took the bus, all 50-some of us, no problems whatsoever. They would take the time to point out some secret police and, kind of try to teach me what to look for when you're looking for secret police. There was also regularly, police clothes, police, kind of along the route, but nobody bothered them. And then afterwards, a few hours later after the Mass and after they finished their demonstration, the police did show up. And from what we understand, detained all of them, including their leader, Berta Soler. And where they are right now, usually from what they tell me, they get scattered to a bunch of jails and then dropped off either a few hours or a few days, in some cases, up to a week or two later, in places that are generally far from their homes, so it's hard to get back to, their families.
Well, thank you so much to our correspondent in Havana, Victoria Maki, for that report.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, President Obama is visiting Cuba with a delegation that includes U.S. lawmakers. I spoke with our Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman, to find out which members of Congress are making the trip with Obama and why.
Mike, there are about 24 lawmakers who are in Havana with President Obama. A handful actually traveled on Air Force One, but most of them went on a separate plane for dignitaries heading to Havana. Most are Democrats. Perhaps unsurprisingly, there is more support among Democratic lawmakers for the opening with Cuba than there are among Republicans.
Why is that?
Well, this goes back to the historical trends. In general, Republicans have more closely aligned themselves with the traditional position of the Cuban-American community, which was absolute opposition to anything in Cuba, with Cuba, that had anything to do with Cuba, so long as Fidel or Raul Castro were in power. That has been evolving within the Cuban-American community, particularly among younger Cuban-Americans.
Because they support reestablishing ties, don't they, some of them?
Far more so than their elders. Than their fathers, their grandfathers. Absolutely. But yes, there is still a partisan divide, although I should note that there is, for instance, a Republican senator who traveled on Air Force One with Obama, Jeff Flake of Arizona. And he is no pushover when it comes to conservative causes, but he very much believes that the U.S. embargo failed, that it's time for a new day, and that, in fact, a great catalyst for change in Cuba can be free enterprise. And he thinks that there's a great opportunity here for Americans and Cubans to rub shoulders, for new businesses to be started, and that this will be all for the good.
But even though the U.S. and Cuba have reestablished formal ties, that embargo remains in place. So how do you think this visit by Obama and all the people traveling with him will affect the debate in Congress about the embargo?
Nothing that happens in Havana while President Obama is there will affect one iota the law that is on the books in the United States, which is the U.S. economic embargo of Cuba, which has been in place since 1960. That is true. However, around the margins, you are already seeing change. You are already seeing more Americans traveling to Cuba and the U.S. government essentially turning a blind eye to what would otherwise be a crime. Most Americans up until now have not been able to go to Cuba without risking some sort of penalty. That is being relaxed. And even before then, Congress did pass a law that poked a great big hole in the embargo to allow U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba. In fact, among the Republicans who are very much supportive of President Obama's opening, but who can't really say so for political reasons, are conservative Republicans from the heartland that represent states with huge farming and agricultural interests. And when you talk to them, they will tell you privately that they think this is great, that they think this is all for the good, but they can't travel with President Obama to Cuba because it's just not done if you're a conservative Republican lawmaker.
Maybe not in an election season like we're in now.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much to our VOA Senate correspondent, Michael Bowman, for telling us about what Congress is doing regarding the Cuba visit by Obama.
My pleasure.
Well, turning to our social media segment, our G.I.B. Lee is with us in the studio to bring us the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
What is the buzz on the president's Cuba visit?
President Obama landed in Cuba about an hour ago, as you know, and tweeted, "What's up, Cuba? Just touched down here. Looking forward to meeting and hearing directly from the Cuban people." The White House retweeted that, and within the first 15 minutes, more than 2,400 people liked it. And as of now, about an hour later, more than 20,000 people liked it.
A lot of likes. Well, what is the reaction like so far?
So a lot of excitement, as you can imagine. Harriet Alexander, who is the U.S. correspondent for The Telegraph, and she has been actively tweeting from Havana. She's on Twitter at @H_Alexander, and one of her tweets reads like this. "I have never heard Obama's name be mentioned in so many passing conversations as at the Havana airport today. Excitement palpable. Hashtag Obama in Cuba." That's a trending hashtag, meaning Obama in Cuba in Spanish. But not all of the reactions were positive. Like Victoria mentioned earlier, a group of protesters got arrested ahead of Mr. Obama's arrival. And that group is, of course, the ladies in white, the wives of political prisoners. They were holding their weekly rallies, and hashtag Ladies in White is now trending at this hour.
Okay, well, can you tell us about the reaction in the United States? What are the Republican presidential contenders saying about this?
Very critical things. So the GOP frontrunner in the race to the White House is Donald Trump, and he sent out this tweet. Wow, President Obama just landed in Cuba, a big deal, and Raul Castro wasn't even there to greet him. He greeted the Pope and others. No respect. Another GOP contender, Ted Cruz, tweeted the link to an opinion piece he wrote for Politico titled, In Cuba, Obama will legitimize the corrupt and ignore the oppressed. So definitely not supporting his visit at all. Back to you, Michael.
Yeah, maybe they might even be considered to be party poopers by some, but yeah, they do have some concerns about Obama in Cuba. Well, thank you very much, G. You can find G on Twitter at G Abby Lee, and the show is there too at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Diving for pearls, a dangerous profession, and one that for hundreds of years was the main industry for Gulf states. Today, it's oil, but there's a movement to preserve the heritage and to restore the pearl industry in Muharraq, once the diving center of the past, Nur al-Sayah of UNESCO.
So the idea behind the whole project is also to make pearling a sustainable economy for Bahrain once again.
The discovery of oil and Japan's entrance into the pearl market in 1930 killed the Arabian industry. Today, by protecting offshore oyster beds, Nur al-Sayah says an old tradition can be maintained.
The diving is going to be regulated there in order to sustain sustainable fishing and pearl diving activity.
The area's museums are luring tourists who now understand how important the pearl industry used to be. And by restoring old pearl houses of yesterday, a new foundation is set to bring back a once-dead pearl economy. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. A deal between the European Union and Turkey to curb the flow of migrants to Europe comes into force on Sunday. New arrivals in Greece will be returned to Turkey, where legitimate refugees will then be sent to EU nations for resettlement. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from the Greek island of Lesbos, where most of the migrants have been arriving, there's growing anger at what some of the migrants and their supporters see as an immoral arrangement.
A few kilometres off the coast, NATO warships and Turkish Coast Guard vessels patrol up and down the straits between Lesbos and Turkey. Helicopters watch from the skies. Europe and Ankara are trying to prevent a surge of refugees as the new deal comes into force. On the Lesbos shoreline, volunteers continue their round-the-clock vigil on the lookout for migrant boats. Samuel Radber is from the Swiss Cross volunteer group.
I don't think that political decisions make a big difference for the refugees that will come anyway. They're still willing because they're on their trip for months or years, so they will try.
Like most aid workers here, Radber is scathing of the agreement between Brussels and Ankara.
You can't charge people like you do with goods or money. They are not numbers, they are human beings. So you can't say we send one back and take another to Europe. That's not the way it goes.
Several days of poor weather have prevented many boats from making the crossing. But rescue teams here believe there are hundreds, if not thousands, of refugees waiting to set off. Turkish police say they arrested over 1,700 migrants Saturday along the coastline, along with 16 alleged smugglers. Greece is continuing to move refugees off the islands to the mainland. Somali refugee Abdi Yare Muse was waiting to take the ferry to the city of Kavala Saturday.
I know a lot of foreigners in Istanbul. We need to come, but it is not easy. It's very hard. Some people crying. Some people in the jail. Me, 6 days, arrested the police in Turkish. He took the photos and fingerprinting. I try to come again.
Rumors are circulating across the refugee camps of deportations to Turkey dependent on nationality. Despite assurances from Brussels of fair treatment for refugees, on the front line of the crisis, there are doubts the plan is either workable or legal. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Lesbos Island, Greece.
Christians around the world are celebrating Palm Sunday. Some have traveled to Israel to join observances in the Holy Land. But as we hear from Robert Berger, Jerusalem's festivities have been overshadowed by a wave of unrest.
Palm Sunday dawned in Jerusalem's old city to the sound of bells at the ancient Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The holiday marks Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem 2,000 years ago and the beginning of the Christian Easter Holy Week. Priests chanted the Palm Sunday liturgy, waving olive and palm branches as fragrant incense filled the church where tradition says Jesus was crucified and rose from the dead. But it is a sparse turnout of pilgrims this year in the wake of 6 months of Israeli-Palestinian violence. Palestinian shopkeeper Abu Hassan says Holy Week usually brings crowds of tourists to the old city bazaar, but not this year.
The situation this year, it's very bad. Not so many tourists coming and it's very quiet. And we hope the problem is finished and the people come to visit this Holy Land.
The pilgrims who made the journey were glad they did. Mark Caldwell, who came from the U.S. state of New Jersey, was fascinated by the mixture of Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the old city.
Well, it's been a lifelong dream of mine to be here, and it's an amazing nexus of three Abrahamic religions, so it's very important to me to be here, and it's an amazing historical and spiritual place.
Holy Week continues with two major events. On Good Friday, Christians will retrace the footsteps of Jesus to the 14 stations of the cross. And on Easter Sunday, they will celebrate the resurrection. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The dwarf planet Ceres is the largest body in the asteroid belt. Among the features of the dwarf planet are several bright spots on its surface. The most noticeable spots are located within its Achator crater. Some scientists think that this might indicate that Ceres is more active than any neighbors in the asteroid belt. Now, scientists using the HARPS spectrograph at the European Southern Observatory in Chile have found that these bright spots go through some surprising changes. While the spots have been known to change as Ceres rotates, the scientists have also found that they also vary and brighten during the day. The scientists say that their observations suggest that the bright spots may be made up of a volatile substance and that solar radiation may cause it to evaporate. NASA's Dawn spacecraft has been circling and studying Ceres and its mysterious bright spots since it arrived there about a year ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're with VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. It's time for a look at the American pop world. Here's my colleague Sarah Williams with VOA Music's Nikki Strong.
Okay, Nikki, so let's start with Gwen Stefani. She's got a new CD out.
Yes, she has a new CD. It's called This Is What the Truth Feels Like, and it is indeed about her boyfriend, Blake Shelton, and her divorce from Gavin Rossdale and everything that she's been through. So she shares that when she first presented the list of songs to her label, they were like, these are too personal, too intense. So in response, she rebelled and said, you know what, now I'm going to make it even that much more intense and personal. And she has. The songs are very catchy, and when it comes to Blake, we find out that she really sees him as saving her and that she is definitely in love. Some of the lyrics for the song, for example, Where Would I Be? It says, I was drifting out, then you pulled me in. Where would I be, boy, if you didn't love me, boy? I can't resist. You have the perfect kiss. But she goes on to sing about how he's rare, he's a sapphire, and she really sings his praises. She's obviously in love.
Well, now, Blake Shelton is also releasing new music, correct?
Yeah, now, he just released a single called Come Here to Forget, which tells the story of two people bonding while trying to forget their exes. So he didn't write the song, but the parallels are undeniable. And it really is the perfect setup for his forthcoming album, which he says will also be very personal and will most likely include songs about Gwen Stefani and, of course, his ex-wife, Miranda Lambert.
Well, now Miranda Lambert, she's releasing music as well.
Yes, she's working on stuff. We have nothing yet about whether she's going to release something this year, but she is like the odd woman out. So when the announcement came that they were divorced, she was really reeling from that divorce. She really felt her pain based on the various things she said. And in the interim, Blake was developing this relationship with Gwen Stefani. And so rumors were flying in the tabloids. And then the night of the American Country Association Awards, where Miranda was nominated for, they make the official announcement that they're a couple, which, of course, made a lot of country fans feel a certain kind of way. Because it was like, you know, dude, could you wait till afterwards?
Yeah.
But now that she has a new romance blooming with an artist, Anderson East, she's now inspired and she's writing music and she's talking a little bit about her process. So we anticipate that she will release her version of events and her life pre and post divorce. If not this year, hopefully sometime early next year.
Very fruitful material there. Well, Gwen Stefani's new CD is called This Is What the Truth Feels Like. You can hear music from Gwen Stefani, Blake Shelton, and Miranda Lambert on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki Strong on social media at @VOA_music and on Facebook at simply VOA Music. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
Where'd you go? I got so used to being around you, boy. I'm trying not to care, but where'd you go?
Well, you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Stay with VOA for more coverage of Obama's visit to Cuba in the coming days, including an update on the next International Edition at 0330 UTC. Well, your director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Daryl Smith. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We'll see you next time, and have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
All across Ukraine, people are standing up and sacrificing for universal values such as sovereignty, territorial integrity, human rights, dignity, clean and accountable government, and justice for all. The United States, said U.S. Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland, has a profound national interest in Ukraine's success. Today, Ukraine's European future is put at risk as much by enemies within as by external forces such as Russia. Ukraine's oligarchs and kleptocrats who controlled Ukraine for decades know their business model will be broken if Maidan reformers succeed in 2016. They are fighting back with a vengeance, said Assistant Secretary Nuland, using all levers of the old system, their control of the media, state-owned enterprises, Rada deputies, the courts, and the political machinery, while holding old loyalties and threats over the heads of decision-makers to block change. It is critical for Ukraine's leaders to set aside their differences and put their people and country first. All those who call themselves reformers must rebuild consensus behind a leadership team and an international monetary fund and European Union compliant program of aggressive measures to clean up corruption, restore justice, and liberalize the economy. The 2016 U.S. assistance program for Ukraine is designed to take on these challenges. Specifically, it is helping Ukraine clean up its energy sector by demonopolizing its gas market, supporting the appointment of a new prosecutor general who is committed to prosecuting corruption and asset recovery cases, and improving the business climate by streamlining the bureaucracy and moving ahead with privatization. In addition, Ukraine's judicial independence must be strengthened. Key services must be improved, including healthcare, education, and transportation. And finally, Ukraine's Ministry of Defense needs to be modernized. With strong, unified leadership in Kyiv, 2016 can and should be a turning point year for Ukraine's sovereignty and European future. As Ukraine's leaders recommit to drive the country forward, the United States will be there to support them. As Assistant Secretary Nuland said, we must be no less rigorous than the Ukrainian people themselves in demanding Kyiv's leaders take their responsibility now to deliver a truly clean, strong, and just Ukraine while they still have the chance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.